This is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
A good Wednesday morning to you. Mike McNamara for another battlefield study. And it's kind of a unique one. A while ago, I did a battlefield study with retired Marine Corps General Butch Neal. And we talked about the Flaming Eye, India Company, 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines. And one of the squad leaders that was a part of the battle for Gitlin's, what's now known as the Battle of Gitlin's Corner, reached out to me, and so I want to introduce you this morning to the squad leader of 2nd Squad, 2nd Platoon, India Company, 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines, former United States Marine Corporal, Jack Riley. So, Jack, first of all, welcome to All Marine Radio, and thanks for reaching out, and thanks for doing this.
Well, thanks, Mike. I appreciate you having me on.
All right. Now, before we listen to your story, we have to learn a little bit about you so we can decide if we should believe you or not. Born and raised where?
Born and raised in Gadsden, Alabama. I was born in 1944, so. That put me right in the perfect age group for the Vietnam War.
So why is Gadsden famous? Why do I know?
Well, Gadsden at one time had the largest tire company in the world. Goodyear still has manufactures automobile tires there. There's been a couple of Medal of Honor recipients there as well. So one of them... is Ola Lee Mize. Lee is my wife's first cousin's husband. Lee just passed away a couple of years ago, but Lee was awarded the Medal of Honor for Outpost Harry in Korea, and he's just a real super guy. Always tried his best to get me to join the Army. was highly perturbed when I joined the Marine Corps.
How does the Marine Corps get on your radar? So you're growing up in Gadsden, in the aftermath of World War II during Korea, you probably couldn't walk anywhere or go to school or do anything or play sports in Gadsden, Alabama without having a veteran being a significant part of your life. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar, Jack?
Well, I did know a few Marines that were World War II veterans. My brother-in-law-to-be, was in the Marine Corps at that time. He was with the 6th Marines up at Camp Lejeune. But the main thing was... I got married, and my wife and I got married in April of 65. My dad told me the best advice he could ever give me was after we married was to move my wife far away from her mama so she would have to depend on herself. So I applied for a job at Southern Bell Telephone and was one of the fortunate ones to be selected to go to work for them. And being one of 8 kids, I had to pay my own way through school. And so I was going to school at night, taking a full load. And I was working full-time at the Southern Bell Telephone. And then in December of that year, I got my greetings letter from Uncle Sam. And I knew that I had to do something pretty quick. I didn't just want to be a draftee. I had planned to serve after I completed my degree, but after I did have a about a year and a half of college when I joined the Marine Corps instead. I knew that I was going to Vietnam, and I just told my wife, I said, well, I'm going to Vietnam no matter what I do, so I think I'll go with an outfit that'll have my, that I'll get the best chance to come home alive with. So I joined the Marine Corps.
The I want you to tell your recruiting story, because that's pretty funny. The explain the uncle. You said Uncle Sam sent me an introduction letter. Your choices at the time. There was guys who tried to join the reserves, right? You could either play the lottery game to see if you were going to be part of the draft, or you could go sign up. And talk about your choices back then in terms of for a lot of people who don't even understand how all that was done.
Well, back in those days, at least here in Alabama, the draft board selected who they wanted to induct, and there was no lottery in those days. The lottery came years later. But the draft board, I was living in Atlanta, Georgia, so I was no longer a resident of Etowah County, but I was still in the Etowah County draft board. So they just looked at it and said, well, here's so-and-so and so-and-so. They don't even live here anymore. We'll draft them. and that's what they did.
So that was one option. if your fate in the hands of the draft board. And then obviously, you know, since you have different politicians who tried to, whether it be service in the reserves or whatnot, to try to avoid service.
But I just didn't see myself going into the reserves at that time. You know, after I got out of the Corps, after I got out of active duty, had I had time to do it, I believe I would have. I had several people trying to encourage me to come back in. They were needing combat veterans in reserve units.
Right,
and,
right.
But, you know, I was working on my degree. I finally finished all of my degree requirements. And then I've got kids coming along, and I'm working, from candle paint running quarries. And, so it was just a matter of I didn't have time to do anything with the reserves.
All right, we'll talk about so what year do you when do you enlist and when do you head to Parris Island?
Well, I got to Parris Island 1st of February of 1966, and had a of course. You have to remember, in 1966, in February 66, segregation was still the order here in the South, just about. And, so here I am, a white boy from Alabama, and I get to Parris Island, and I meet my drill instructor, and my senior drill instructor is about 6'4", and weighed about 240, and I'm a little guy, I'm 6 feet, and at that time I weighed 230, and, but, you know, he was an African American, and, you know, I thought, this may not go too well. But, you know, it turned out that, we did have some blacks in my platoon that, you know, sadly, and no fault of their own, but their education opportunities just weren't that great at that time. And I think every Marine knows that there are many, many things you have to memorize in boot camp. And these guys were having a difficult time with it. And back in those days, brutality at Parris Island was just, well, that's just the way it was. You know, you just had to, that was the Marine Corps back in those days. And I just hated to see these guys be put to, you know, to that. Under those circumstances, that kind of punishment. So after lights were out at night, I started taking these guys into the head and drilling them on there what they had to memorize so they wouldn't get the crap beat out of them the next day. And lo and behold, I told the fire watch, I said, now, if the SDI gets, you know, you hear him rustling getting up, you come get us so we can get out of the head. Of course, he was a whole wooden barrack at Paris Island. And you could hear somebody walking at the other end of the hall. And one night he did get up. He stuck his head in. He stuck his head into the hatch there, and he saw me back there drilling these guys, you know, with questions. And he just backed out of the tune's head and used their head. And never said a word to me. So he and I, after graduation from boot camp, unfortunately I was one of the honor men to graduate. And after graduation, I kept in touch with him, and he wrote back and forth to me, and because he was a frozen chosen Marine. And he felt like he should be in Vietnam already, but there he was at Paris Island, you know, as a SDI. And, but he finally got his promotion to gunny, and, he wrote me and he says, well, I forgot my orders. I'm coming to 3rd Marine Division. I don't know what regiment yet, but he said he'd look me up when he got over there. And, so he came, he became the company gunny for Delta 1-4. And when he first got to Vietnam, he did stop by Camp Carroll. I believe Delta 1-4 was at Con Phien at that time. And, but he stopped in, and he actually knew my first sergeant. And, they had a nice little reunion get together. And so I was out in the bush for a few days, came back in. My first sergeant said, Riley, I don't know what the hell you've done, but the biggest, blackest Marine I've ever seen said if you didn't get to Cotton, he's going to kick your ass. And I said, oh, Gunny Elliott must be in Vietnam. He said, oh, you know this guy. So, but sadly, I went up to see him, and when I got there, it was the second week of May, and he had been killed on May the 8th. Took a direct hit. It was a real sad situation.
Hey, first of all, why do you want to come on the air and tell fucked up stories like that, Jack? You're about to get thrown right off the radio program. We haven't even started yet. Jeez. No, well, that's a terrible story. I thought you were going to have seen him, and it turns out well, but not that way. Not that way.
No. He was a great guy. And, you hear a lot of Marines say this, but, you know, it's the truth for me. That man had as big an impact on me as any Marine I ever met. I still credit him with the discipline that he instilled in us right there at Paris Island, you know, for all the crap that we went through in Vietnam.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm sure he lived it, you know, as at the Chosen Reservoir, they leaned on their discipline pretty hard, and they learned firsthand why these things were important, that this discipline will ultimately save your life, and all the things that you think are chicken shit, from Irish penance to MNU to the way we do drill, if you ever go fight, you'll thank God that you were a part of this, because it works.
Yeah,
and it especially works in combat. Talk to us about how do you get to Vietnam. So obviously you graduate SOI. You head to Camp Lejeune, and you head to Vietnam right away, or did you go to Pendleton? What's the route to Vietnam?
Well, we went to Camp Pendleton, and Camp Pendleton at that time had a series of schools that you went through to try to, you know, educate us.
Right.
Of course, in those days, SOI was pretty much still World War II type training. And, once we got out to Pendleton, they tried to add a little jungle warfare training to it. I think the biggest thing I got out of Pendleton was the escape and evasion, the POW, camp they had set up that everybody had to go through. We were all, you hear waterboarding, right. Torture. You hear that all the time, but every Marine that went through training back then was waterboarded just so you would know what to expect.
Right.
So waterboarding wasn't a big deal. It was just something everybody, like the gas chamber, you had to go through. But the training was good, but getting to Vietnam, that's when the real training started, and thank the good Lord I had an outstanding fire team leader and squad leader and platoon sergeant when I first got there that saw that I wanted to do things the right way. I wanted to apply what I'd learned, and I've always been a pretty good listener, and I've so many times in battle, after battle's over, I've heard Marines say, man, I really do wish I'd paid more attention to that when we were doing it in class.
Right.
Well, that's when you have to pay attention to it, because a Marine has faced it in a battle somewhere at some time, and you need to be prepared for everything.
You know what, I often say that the thing that I learned in sports growing up from my dad, who was in professional baseball, was how to keep my head in the game. And that has served me my entire life, to keep your head in the game. So interesting. Talk to me, Jack, about your get to Vietnam. Who are you assigned to? You're what, private PFC when you get to Vietnam? Tell me about what year, what time of year do you get there, and who are you with, and what are you doing?
Well, I got there in July of 66. I joined India Company 3-9. My platoon commander at that time was a lieutenant by the name of Peterson. My platoon sergeant was a staff sergeant by the name of Guy Hodgkins, and my squad leader was a sergeant by the name of Bob Hickey, and my fire team leader was a lance corporal by the name of Cassius Meisner, and his nickname was Mongoose. Everybody just called him Mongoose, but all of them.
That's a great nickname, though.
Oh yeah. You think about it, especially in Vietnam.
Yeah, that's
but it. They were great Marines that didn't just say, "Well, let's just do what I do." I asked a 1,000 questions, and they were all very good to talk about why we did things this way instead of the way it was taught in SOI. But my staff sergeant was killed. This July, he was killed in September and awarded the Navy Cross. His name was Guy Hodgkins, and Guy attacked a enemy machine gun position with just two grenades and took out the bunker, but in trying to get back away from the bunker, another position took him under fire, and unfortunately he was killed, but he was a super Marine.
So you get to Vietnam, in July of 1966. What job do you have? Where in Vietnam are you, Jack? And what are you guys doing?
Well, I back then the fire teams only had three Marines. Company never reached TO ever. While we were operating down in south of Da Nang, out of our headquarters was at An Hoa. And most of the guys that later served in the 1st Marine Division are very familiar with An Hoa, because Anwa is the area, the Anwa Basin, that whole basin area. So many battles took place down in that area. That's where Gunny Hathcock, you know, that right. wrote the book about the sniper, that he was at Hill 55. But we operated all over the Anwa Basin, the Antenna Valley area, the what they call, later called the Arizona Territory, Godoy Island. We were mainly fighting a VC battalion down in that area called the ARC 20th Battalion. Mr. Long was he was actually a colonel in the VC. But he was their commanding officer, and we ran a big battle with him in September. That was about 3 days long. We finally caught up with them and wiped them out. So, we had 66 Marines wounded that day and not a single one killed.
Wow. Jack, if you can lay out for everybody in terms of geography, the area that you're talking about, I think most people, if you go from north to south along the coast, Dong Ha up near the DMZ, and then Da Nang, the big naval base. Explain to everybody listening, and again, the maps are on the maps are on the website that have this stuff. All you got to do is you got to click on this interview, and then click on the maps, and they'll open up. But explain to everybody relative to Da Nang where you guys are when you in your first part of the time that you're in Vietnam.
Anwa is about best I remember about 15 miles. South-southwest of Da Nang, inland from the coast. We weren't on the coast at all. In fact, Anwa Basin is surrounded by mountains. And we were operating primarily out of there. Of course, in those days, the platoon and the company as a whole was so short that we were pulling things down south, or when I say pulling things, we were doing things operationally much different than we would ever do up north. Down south, we routinely had what we call three-man, or in other words, a fire team, hunter-killer team. So three men would go out, you'd patrol, you'd set up an ambush, and the routine was vastly different also because If you had an ambush, it meant that you had to pull two ambushes in one night. The next night, you would only have to pull one ambush. But when you weren't on an ambush at night, you were standing lines at the patrol base. We spent the majority of our time along the Song Thu Bon River at a ferry crossing called Phulak 6. And, we worked out of there a lot. That was where the majority of the enemy activity along that river going from, all the way from the old Arizona Territory all the way up through, Godoy Island. And then across that river over the Hill 55. But then we did pull squad patrols also. You know, if somebody saw something, we'd send a squad out or a reinforced squad out with guns. And then we were on a lot of operations back then also, all over that territory. Many times we were out there as a blocking force for the Army. And, you know, you've read and you've heard people say that the Army weren't very good. Well, a lot of them weren't, but, you know, I was an eyewitness to a case on a big sandbar right along Godoy Island one time where I saw some Armans attacking an enemy machine gun position just one right after the other. These guys were attacking that position, and they were as brave as anybody I've ever seen. So I'm sure there were some Arvins that, you know, that ran, that didn't want to fight, but the Arvins we were with around that area, they were sure enough that they were fighting for their country, that's for sure.
Talk to us about, before we talk about the 3-9 heading to Okinawa, talk to me about the strength. You said that you guys were down to 40% by the time you guys get ready to go back to Okinawa or go to Okinawa in January. That's pretty thin. That's a pretty thin battalion.
Well, it's very thin. And in fact, when they pulled us out of Anwa, we were replaced in Anwa by 2-5, and 2-5 took over. In fact, the 5th Marines, that became 5th Marines Regimental Headquarters there, I believe, later. And but when we were put up into the, transferred into the mountains north of Da Nang, up in the High Band, or along High Band Pass, my platoon was on Hill 358, and we were patrolling the southern flanks of Hill 1192. Now, if you want to have your butt kicked, you know, you start patrolling those mountains, and as slippery and as steep and as that place was, but you know. Some outfits were sent to Vietnam as a whole battalion.
Right.
And during this period of time, that they were going to have a whole battalion going home at the same time. So they started pulling a bunch of Marines out of one outfit, sending them to another outfit. So what happened with us, several of our Marines were left at Anwa to stay with the 5th Marines, and at the same time, we had several Marines join us that had been with the 26th Marines and the 4th Marines. So they were, what they were trying to do was have the replacement dates spread out enough so it wouldn't hurt them manpower-wise.
Wow. Well, so you wind up, and so in January of 1967, what rank are you? And is at this time, is Lieutenant Bobo your platoon commander? Gives us kind of set the stage for you guys going to Okinawa for us.
Yeah, Lieutenant Bobo was. I was a Lance Corporal at that time. I'd been a fire team leader for a good while, and then I was promoted to Corporal at that time, and went up to north with Lieutenant Bobo as our platoon commander, and once we left Hill 358 to go to Okinawa, that was in January of 67. John, then after we got to Okinawa again, and I did say, you know, we were at 40%, just so everybody understand, at least all the Marines will understand. We went by ship, we were on a APA, and we had all four rifle companies in the battalion on one APA, so that gives you an idea of how short we were at that time of manpower.
Wow. And an ATA is we don't have any more, but some kind of it's an amphibious ship, yes?
No, it was an old flat bottom troop carrier it didn't have a well deck or anything in it like an LST. It was a much smaller ship.
Wow.
But we were all on that one ship, and had so many on that thing, you know, it was just, you got out of line, morning chow, got to the end of the line for noon chow, end of the line again for evening chow. So,
well,
but I do, I did want to tell you how cruel the Navy is to the Marine Corps. Here we had been in Vietnam fighting. Well, I'd been in Vietnam fighting for about 7 months at that time. And here we are aboard ship, and, you know, we're not getting shot at. We are, the sea's a little rough, but, you know, you guys are seasick, is always the case when it gets a little choppy out there. And but anyhow, the skipper of the boat said, well, we're going to have a movie topside on the top side for the Marines. And the scuttlebutt got around. It was going to be Ann Margaret's new movie. I don't know what the movie was, but it was Ann Margaret. So, everybody knew about Ann Margaret.
Yeah, did anybody care what the movie was as long as,
No, that didn't give a hoot, but here's how cruel the Navy is. So we get topside to watch this Ann Margaret movie, and the film starts. And it's Sands of Iwo Jima with John Wayne.
No.
Oh, yeah. Of course, we've seen it 100 times. And the movie down in the galley was the Ann Margaret movie for the ship's company.
Of course.
Yeah.
Couldn't we have swapped movies the following night? What the hell?
No, they only showed it. You know, the weather was so bad, they said they couldn't show it but one time. So, you know the Navy.
There you go. Tell us about, before we talk about your time on Okinawa and your kind of refitting operations, tell us about Lieutenant Bobo. He is, if you're an officer in the Marine Corps, you are used to seeing things with his name on it. Most of us have read his Medal of Honor citation. You're the second person I've had on the program that knew him personally. Tell us about him.
Well, John and I served together from the time he got to Vietnam till the day he was killed. And, John was a super guy. He was physically very strong. Anybody that's ever read anything about it, has heard the story about him not making the football team because the coach said he was too scrawny. So John took up weightlifting and became, you know, very strong at that. And my first encounter with him in Vietnam, I was a boot myself. I'd only been there a couple of weeks longer than he had, but he had a very good platoon sergeant in Guy Hodgkins who recognized, you know, the old saying in Vietnam was you get one fresh out of Quantico, they were boot butter bars. So you get a new boot butter bar, and the platoon sergeant does a good job of taking care of them, and Sergeant Hodgkins did just that. But John was a calm demeanor. He graduated from Niagara University. He and I hit it off, right from the get-go. I think I was one of the older guys. I turned 22 and 23 in Vietnam, and most of the guys were like 18 and 19. But I'd also been to college, you know, for a couple of years, and John recognized that. So John was always one of my biggest supporters and was always trying to encourage me to go into to apply to the officer candidate program, where he kept telling me, he said, the Marine Corps will pay for your education. And then, you go to OCS and, you know, you come back as an officer. But he said, goodness, you get your education paid for. He was harping on me about that all the time, that me being married, that this wasn't the path I chose to go. But John and I literally spent a lot of time together. He was, and in battle, I'll tell you, one situation that we had in a battle on, this was September the 5th of 1966. We were attacking the R-20th Battalion, VC Battalion, and they had set up a tremendous line of machine gun positions, and we were attacking through this built up area. These weren't like grass huts. These were actually buildings. And, one of the, as we're going through this thing, they had this trench dug through the city, through the little village there, and we're making our way up through there. And John is right behind me. My fire team is in the lead. And a guy, a VC up in a tree, drops a grenade down, and it gets both of us. So John and I got our first Purple Hearts from the very same grenade. and then we're not hurt bad. It was bad enough to be tagged, but it didn't take us out of the battle, so we kept pressing the battle up. We didn't know it at the time that what we were really trying to do was just get in line with the main force to attack with a CP, and we had actually pushed the far end of the village that we were right about 30 feet from the VC's main positions. And there was a stone building that the VC had set up a machine gun in, and we were able to move them out of that position. And well, during we took over their position. Well, John had to move up and take that position over and lay down a base fire against the VC, which really at that point they had three machine guns, and they were putting out a lot of rounds on us. But anyhow, they started dropping mortars on us also, and the rock building we were in fell on three of my fire team. And it really messed one of the guys had a broken back. Another one ended up having one of the worst lacerations in his skull I've ever seen. And for me, it just kind of drove me down into the ground, knocked me out, but it compressed my whole spine, which caused all kinds of medical problems, later on. But, John's initiative in that battle, I mean, we were moving, we were just rolling the VC up on that thing, but this guy had a very calm demeanor, but once you got in the fight, you're in the fight, and he was right there, one of the bravest people you would have ever seen, especially later on, that I'm sure you want to talk about.
No, without a doubt. All right, so you're now headed to Okinawa. Have you been promoted to corporal at that time?
Yeah, I got promoted to corporal right when we went to Okinawa.
All right, so tell everybody. So 3-9 is headed to Okinawa. What's the plan? What are you guys going to do on the island while you're there?
Well, the main thing was to get new men, get replacements for all the troops that have been, either rotated or wounded and evacuated out. Secondly, it was to get new equipment. Our gear was just shot. Thirdly, we needed new rifles. Our rifles were shot out, and our M14s didn't have a lick of blue in on them anywhere. So we were actually getting reconditioned M14s with new barrels and getting all brand new equipment, getting new web gear. Of course, you know, it was actually old web gear, but it was new. It was a lot better than what we had.
Yeah.
We were actually getting more than one uniform, which is the whole time we were there, we ended up wearing a set of jungle trousers and a jungle shirt. and you wore it till it rotted off of you just about because there just wasn't a good supply coming in. I wore leather boots for about 3 months over there before I ever got a pair of jungle boots. But if you went back to the name, around the Air Force and all, everybody there had new boots.
And
the grunts were out in the bush and, you know, we're begging for clothes. It was kind of funny. One time my skipper walked by and I had taken some comb wire. My trousers had split from all the crotch had completely split out of them and I had stitched it back together with some comb wire, and my skipper looked at me and he really got upset knowing that his troops were wearing such pitiful clothing, and he took it on himself to go all the way to Da Nang, and he came back with a whole plane load of stuff. He took care of us.
That's awesome. So you go there, and now you're still shooting the M14, yes?
Oh, yeah. The M14, when I first got to Vietnam, that was just a lame battle rifle that we had. It's interesting that when George Navadale and Captain Navadale took over the company, one of the first things that they did was they were trying to organize the 9th Marine Regiment sniper platoon, and they were taking each company's high shooter that still had a lot of time to do in Vietnam, and they sent us up to Marble Mountain for a sniper school, a real fast program that we went through up there, and then as they formed the sniper platoon, we were to each then, we were to return to our parent company, and then when they formed the platoon, we were supposed to report there. Well, when that happened in my case, this was after the September the 5th battle, and they sent the orders for me to go there, but my skipper decided he'd keep me in India Company. So I stayed in India Company the whole time, but at least having been there, it helped later on after I got my third Purple Heart.
Now, third Purple Heart, don't you get to go home after that?
Well, no, you didn't go home. You just went out of the combat zone.
Okay.
And you still had a 13-month tour you had to do overseas. But in my case, I still, after my third Purple Heart was at Gatlin's Corner. And when I rejoined the company, and then the new first sergeant and my new CO found out I had 3 Purple Hearts, they pull me out of the field, and but fortunately Captain Navadale, who was then in the battalion he was the S4 at that time, and he happened to be at the company office at that time also, and I was trying to convince him to just let me stay on, and in some way. And that's when the skipper, Captain Navadale, told him, he said, well, I sent him to school, and I've got the first of the new Remington 700 Marine Corps sniper rifles for the 9th Marines. And he said, it's his if he wants it. So they agreed to let me stay on, and I became the company sniper after that time.
All right, so talk to us about, you're there in Okinawa, and then when you come back to Vietnam, obviously you head up north, you and Lieutenant Bobo are part of the, ADVON, to go to Camp Carroll, I believe, which was the battalion CP, or the company CP, and we're going to talk about that. My guest, very fortunate to have him today, is what did you get out of the Marine Corps as, Jack? Did you get out as a sergeant? Staff sergeant?
Yeah, I got out as I got promoted to sergeant that next November, so mm-hmm. I got out as a E5, yeah.
Former Marine sergeant and veteran of the Battle of Gettlin's Corner, and that at the time was Corporal Jack Riley. He's gracious enough to join us. So don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio and this battle study, a second phase of Gettlin's Corner. The first part we did with a different perspective with General Neal a couple months ago. So I would tell you, listen to that. It's a great interview. He's a wonderful guy. And as a second lieutenant, was a forward observer for India 39. So we'll take a break. We'll come back. More of Corporal Jack Riley coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. You'll hear that the rest of the interview tomorrow. It's a couple hours. And, pretty in-depth about the fighting that took place at Hill 70. Now known as the Gettlin's Corner, named after Captain Mike Gettlin, who was a company commander. You'll also find, I'll finish it up probably in the next couple hours, but a list of the all the awards that were given out as a result of this fight. I'll go down the list. Medal of Honor to Lieutenant, Second Lieutenant Bobo, Navy Cross, Captain Mike Gettlin, Navy Cross, First Sergeant Ray Rogers, Navy Cross, Doc Kenneth Braun, Navy Cross, Corporal John Laurinaitis, Silver Star, First Lieutenant Richard Neal, Butch Neal, Silver Star to Lance Corporal Jim Burghart, Silver Star to Lance Corporal Gene Chamberlain, and just Bobo is essentially when you hear, first of all, if you're an officer in the Marine Corps, you know Lieutenant Bobo. Okay, you've at some point been standing in front of something that has his Medal of Honor citation on it, and you sit there and you read it and you go, wow. The other, it's similar to the Medal of Honor citation of Lieutenant Terrence Graves, who covers the withdrawal of his reconnaissance team after his legs blown off. He self-tourniquets and then jams it in a rice paddy dike and grabs an M60 and tells them that he'll cover their withdrawal, and he dies that way. Bobo has a Remington, I think it's a Mossberg pump shotgun, and he's essentially on the left flank, if I'm not mistaken, he's on the left flank of the, he stays with the headquarters element, the company headquarters. There's a machine gun team. Bobo stays with that, and there's two mortar tubes that stay with the a rocket team that stay with the company headquarters, and then there's two rifle squads and a FAC team and the FO. And well, the FO goes with is Neil. He goes with first platoon. So Bobo stays with the company CP. He's providing local security for his machine gun team. And when he's wounded, his leg partially blown off. All that's left is his stump where his leg's blown off, and then skin and probably tendons and shit that are holding his leg together. So they tourniquet that, and he's killed as he's being drugged back to a position of shelter as they try to withdraw off the front part of that hilltop. So anyway, Second Lieutenant John Bobo, Navy Cross, Captain Mike Gettlin, who was killed in action there, Navy Cross, First Sergeant Ray Rogers, First Sergeant's out there because the gunny couldn't go, Rogers survives, he was wounded in action, Navy Cross to Kenneth Braun, which is awarded 38 years after the fight, Navy Cross to Corporal John Laurinaitis. The barracks at Camp Geiger is named in his honor. The chow hall at Officer Candidate School named after Bobo, Lieutenant Bobo, as is as an MPF ship, I believe, is named after Lieutenant Bobo. Silver Stars, Lieutenant Butch Neal, for leading 1st Platoon after Lieutenant Prickett was shot. He later assumes command of the company after both the CO and the XO had been killed on Hill 70. Silver Star Lance Corporal Jim Burghardt, he lays over Lieutenant Prickett after he's wounded by machine gun fire to protect him. Silver Star Lance Corporal Gene Chamberlain repels a NVA attack on his flank. Laurinaitis, his Navy Cross, he charges a machine gun. You'll hear about that. Silver Star Lance Corporal Tom Butt, M60 team leader, directing his team after being wounded. Silver Star PFC Bill Stankowski, rocket team leader, Silver Star for helping take wounded to a helicopter LZ under fire. Bronze Star Lance Corporal Gail Weller, Bronze Star with a V for leading his fire team on a reconnaissance mission and killing 20 enemy. Bronze Star Staff Sergeant Francis Muldowney with V for leading an assault on the enemy flank. Bronze Star Lieutenant Ray Gould, 3rd Platoon leader, who was wounded in action, with V device for his actions with his platoon during the battle. So, one Medal of Honor, 1, 2, 3, 4 Navy Crosses, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 Silver Stars, and 3 Bronze Stars. I don't know that I've ever seen anything like that. And I've read a lot of Marine Corps stuff, for one battle. Okay. And you don't see this stuff a lot. Well, the only way this happens is if you get put in a very, very bad situation. And that's what happened that day. And so, just want to thank, Jack Riley, who spent about 3.5 hours, close to 4 hours with me yesterday. And so, it's just a great privilege, to talk to him and meet him and get to spend some time with him. So, I'll post all these, this awards list I'll post, that Jack made and sent to me. There's also the citations, the Navy Cross citation and the Medal of Honor citations will be posted as well. So give me a couple hours and I will I'll take care of that. So but pretty amazing fight that India 39 was a part of. So don't touch that dial. We continue. The gunner should be joining us here momentarily. So Tuesday, the 2nd day of October. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on All Marine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing. From VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it, the McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on All Marine Radio, on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.